some. Give me some more.
Addict named Seamus. Thank you. Thank you. First, I'd like to say God bless Rose for those who know her. Hearts and prayers are with you. And you know what I'd like to do? I think this is a good way to start off a convention. Let's everybody get up and give up some hugs. And I mean N.A. hugs. Not that hang your arm over the person. I mean hug this person if you like them, if you don't like them. If they don't like you, got resentment against them, hug them even longer. That's it. Whew. That's it. The reason that I think that's a good way to start out the convention is because the truth is that I want to keep my walls up and I want to push people out of my life because I'm afraid to let people in, because I'm afraid to let people let them know that I'm scared and that I'm hurting and that I need love and that I need help. And you know, the theme of this tradition is unity, you know, and unity and anonymity to me go hand in hand. The first in the 12th tradition, it says that I got to get my personality out of the way and I got to love people in spite of their personalities, and hopefully people will love me in spite of my personality, because that's what got me clean, you know, was people loving me in spite of myself. And unity doesn't mean that I have to agree with what everybody says, and it doesn't mean that I have to like everybody. It doesn't mean that everybody has to like me or agree with what I say. But when I first got clean, they used to tell me all the time, you don't have to like everybody, but you damn sure have to love everybody. And I'm thankful to those people that have loved me in spite of myself, because they've taught me to love myself. They've taught me to become myself. And in the second tradition, I find out why that's possible, and it's because of a loving God, because of a loving higher power that we may let come here. If we're willing to give those hugs, if I'm willing to let down those walls, if I'm willing to say I am scared and I need help and I don't feel good about me and I don't know how to live, if I'm willing to let that happen and let a loving God come in, then we can have hope that we can find the message in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, in a third tradition, talking about just the desire. It doesn't have to be honest. It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be sincere. Other people don't even have to see that I have it. That's not important. When I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I did not have the desire to stop using. I had the desire to stop hurting. And I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live anymore. And I didn't get clean the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting that I came to. And I've been to a lot of Narcotics Anonymous meetings high. And people hugged me and told me to keep coming back. And they told me that they loved me anyway. And I'm grateful for that. Because one of the biggest offenders of having a little time is I think that I know something. You know, and there's nothing worse than an addict like myself getting self-righteous. You know, after all the whoring and stealing and lying and robbing and prostituting that I've done, I come in here and I get a little time and I want to start judging what other people should and shouldn't be doing. Oh, you know what I'm saying? And what the third tradition tells me is that everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome and everybody's loved, regardless of how I feel or what I think. And I'm grateful to the people that were practicing those principles before that I got here, because the responsibility is on me as a member to love people that don't know what these principles are, and to welcome them and to open up my arms and to share with them that there is a message of hope. and that they can get clean and stay clean in this fellowship, regardless of what neighborhood they live in or what color their skin is or what they look like or what their sexual preference is. That's none of my business. All my business is to open up my arms and give up that hug and say, I love you. And I hope that I never stay clean so long that I forget that. I hope that I never forget what it's like to need to get high. And I hope I never forget what it's like to need help. Because my denial wasn't that I had a drug problem. My denial was death. I needed other people to help me. In the fifth tradition, you know, the fourth tradition talks about groups' personalities and how we can express the message. I like them smoky, cramped, hot meetings in a city where people say fucking motherfucker all the time. I like those kind of meetings. Some people like air conditioning, no smoking, and that's personal preference. I like it dirty. I like it rough. I like it ugly. I like them addicts coming in scratching and, you know, stinking. I like that, man. You know, that takes me home. I want to feel that. You know what I mean? I like it. Because this is not a pretty sickness for me. I didn't come to Narcotics Anonymous because a few pot seeds popped on my shirt. I came here because I could not stop using. And the fifth tradition keeps us focused on the fact that what my responsibility is to stay clean and to share with other people how to stay clean. You know, and collectively, I heard this girl up on Greenmont Avenue say, intellectually, I'm a member when I say I am, but spiritually, I'm a member when I act like I am. You know? And I was real fortunate. When I got clean, the people that were around, they told me to wipe up coffee spills whether they were mine or not. They told me to throw away coffee cups whether they were mine or not. They told me not to hang outside the meeting and blast my radio and disrespect the neighborhood because my very life depended upon that Narcotics Anonymous meeting existing and the message being in there. Because it's not meetings that keep me clean. It's what we share in meetings that keeps me clean. And having the respect and the love for the fellowship where I appreciate the opportunity and the grace of a love and higher power to be able to come there and find hope. You know, then what they say and what I believe is that Narcotics Anonymous cannot be destroyed from the outside. The only thing that can destroy this fellowship is our self-centeredness. And I believe that. When I stop loving people unconditionally, when I get so caught up in my personality and taking other people's inventory and not hugging this one and not hugging that one and separating myself from that unconditional love, that starts to tear down the message. Because the message is that an addict, any addict, can get clean, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. That's what it says in the fifth tradition. And I am responsible to share that message that y'all shared with me absolutely without reservation. I am indebted and I owe my life to the people that were here before me and the people that have come after me and taught me how to live life. You know, in the seventh tradition of the six is non-affiliation and trying to keep us focused and responsible for what we're supposed to be focused and responsible for, and that's spiritual living, as far as I understand it. You know, because if there was a president of Narcotics Anonymous, I'd be running for it. You know, if I could be like the man in charge, if I could like do that, I would, because my ego wants that power and wants that control. And what that sixth tradition tells me is that I got to put all that stuff aside, the money, property, and prestige, talks about social acceptability and the basic text, and tying all these principles to my personal recovery. Seventh tradition talks about, I believe it talks about group responsibility. You know, it doesn't just talk about money, it talks about group responsibility. It talks about me being a home group member, you know. It talks about respecting the place that I have the meeting and respecting the people that allow us to have the meeting there and the space that we ran. And it talks about me contributing if I can. And if I can't, then I can always wipe up coffee or I can always do anything to be a responsible member. Narcotics Anonymous is home groups. You know, It's home groups all over this world. And I'm a home group member. And when you come to my home group, I'm going to give you a hug. And I'm going to tell you I love you. And I'm going to tell you to keep coming back. And I do everything that I can to participate in my home group so that when addicts come to that meeting, they find what I found. The message of hope. Recovery and the fellowship. The 11th tradition, you know, I go to 8, 9, 9 professional. What that says to me is that all addicts are equal. No matter how long I've been clean, no matter how many times I've worked the steps, no matter how many service positions I've held, I'm not a professional recovering addict. I don't get paid for sponsorship monetarily. I get paid spiritually. And that we're all equal and that all membership is equal, whether I got one day or no days or a million days. You know? The 9th tradition is what allows this to take place. The 9th tradition is what allows us to set up phone lines and conventions and take those meetings into those jails where those people desperately need to hear that there's a way up and a way out. Because it says NA is such, and our services are not the fellowship. They're services of the fellowship. You know, they're services that we lovingly provide and give the PI committee to let other people know, you know, that Narcotics Anonymous exists. Not to sell Narcotics Anonymous, not to have neon signs, but to humbly and gratefully say that we found a way to live drug free. And I think that leads right into the, you know, 11 tradition about press, radio, and films and trying to keep myself in check. Because this is not an I thing. This is a we thing. This is not my message. This is our message. And I have to be conscious of that and I have to respect that. If somebody asks me to go on the radio or somebody asks me to do an interview, I have to talk to people and share and find out and get guidance and information on how to go about dealing with that. Because my ego wants to jump in there and say, yeah, let me tell you how many years I've been clean and I used to shoot dope and, well, you know, say all this stuff to blow myself up. And a lot of times I pervert the message because I let my own personality get in the way. And it talks about attraction rather than promotion, and what that means is unity. That means living it. That means showing up and doing it. That doesn't mean saying all this neato stuff. That means people coming and seeing that we're about what we say we're about. You know? And that's what's attractive. That's what attracted me to Narcotics Anonymous, was that people love me in spite of how hateful and miserable and bitter and angry and lonely and hopeless and desperate I felt. They reached out to me and said that I could find a better way to live. And like I say, anonymity for me is about freedom. Anonymity is about me learning how to be myself and letting other people learn to be themselves and loving people, you know, learning to agree to disagree. And that's hard. Because when your self-esteem is as low as mine is, you'll cling to anything for a little validation, for a little recognition, just for somebody to say you're okay. And anonymity forces me to go inside myself with my relationship with my higher power and learn to validate myself, learn to become secure in who I am, learn to love the person that my higher power put me on this earth to be. And the reason that I shared about all that is because in 1953, before I was born, addicts were thinking about me. Addicts were thinking about the addict that hadn't even been born. They were thinking about the addicts to come into the fellowship other than themselves. You know? And all the millions of dollars that we spent on translating literature and setting up the World Service Office and writing the basic text and all the changes that we've gone through with It Works, how and why, and all the struggles that we go through in NA politics is for every single solitary addict to have a chance to find a better way to live. Because the individual addict is at the top of the service structure, and all the services and all the money and all the effort and all the things that we do is so that addict that's out there using right now may have the opportunity to find a Narcotics Anonymous meeting somewhere in this world. And I owe my life to that. I started huffing and bombing fluid when I was 10 years old underneath this bridge by my house. That's how I started using drugs. And lacquer thinner, and gasoline, and airplane glue. I was 10 years old, and I could not stand being in my own skin. And I sought to be around other people that could not stand being in their own skin. I looked for the people that felt like I did. You know, and I didn't realize that for a long time. And I was on probation by the time I was, 15 years old. My life was totally consumed in the use of drugs, and I was still a kid. And using drugs for me was not about partying. You know, I wasn't somebody that was going to the dance looking for a good time, going to have a few beers and snort a little coke and, try to get laid. That wasn't me. I spent my life in a fucking bathroom trying to blow my heart up, hoping and praying that this was the next last one, because I didn't want to feel the way that I was feeling anymore. I remember when I was 15 years old, I had ran away from home and I had no clothes, and I was living in this, it was like this little kid's playground. It was a little, like a jail cell, it was about the size of the cell. And I remember it had a old rusty wire box spring on the floor. And I remember waking up in the morning and having welts all over my body from the bugs crawling over my skin. And I remember not taking showers for weeks on, not even cleaning up for weeks on end, and being a kid, because I lived to get high. And I couldn't understand why everybody else wasn't like me. All these people were going home, and they were like eating and doing all, like normal people do, going to school. And I was like breaking into houses and breaking into cars and committing crimes and all that stuff just to keep from being in my own skin. The only reason that I ever used drugs was because I did not like who I was. People that stick needles in their arm and smoke PCP until they don't know what their own name is and come to in their own puke and their own piss do not like who they are. I could not stand being in my own skin. I was afraid of relationships. Man, there's nothing wrong with relationships. They're hard and they're painful, but they're worth it. I was afraid of responsibility. I was afraid of intimacy. I was afraid of everything. When I was 8 years old, I wanted to be a professional baseball player. That was my dream. When I was 20 years old, I came to in a mental hospital in a concrete room in a paper bag with a barbiturate habit, wondering how the fuck I got there. And I remember being in that room, and I remember the doctor coming in, and I'm sitting there crying, and they got the little plastic mirror, and they got the door locked, and they're peeking in on me. And I'm sitting there with this little mat on the floor, and the bugs are crawling through my skin on my legs and the hairs on my legs, and I'm just sitting there. And this psychiatrist comes in. He's got on a suit, $1,200, and he sat down on the floor. And I looked at him, and I said, I can't quit. I can't stop. And he asked me what I was going to do. If you passed me walking down the street, you knew that I had a drug problem. But I wasn't willing to do anything. That was my problem. I wasn't willing to ask for help. I didn't think that I needed help. I could do it myself. And I jonesed that barbiturate habit for 6 weeks in a psychiatric institute in Montgomery County. And that is the absolute hardest thing that I've ever done. The second hardest thing I've ever done is stay clean. Getting clean was the first hardest. And they wanted me to go to treatment center in Minnesota. I wouldn't go. My father begged me. My father's from Spanish Harlem in New York. He doesn't show his feelings. He begged me. He told me to sell his house. He pleaded with me in front of like 50 people to go. And I wouldn't go because I didn't need to go, because I didn't need y'all. I could do it myself. And 117 days later, after I left, I stayed there for 6 weeks. I hitchhiked back to New Jersey. And 117 days, I got high. And this was like the beginning of the end for me. On December the 13th, 1983, good old San Juan Hill, I took a razor blade and I cut the main veins in my arm in half because I couldn't stop. And I couldn't take being the thing that I had become. I was a fucking animal. You know, I was not nice. I was not pleasant. I didn't want to talk to people. I didn't want to be around anybody. You know, my life was about passing out and coming to. And about after laying there for about, I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours, somebody found me. They called ambulance, and the ambulance came and got me. They took me to the hospital in Jersey and put 13 stitches in my arm, and they kept me overnight for observation. And they let me go about 6 o'clock in the morning. I went right to San Juan Hill, copped some dope, got high, fell down a flight of steps, ripped all the stitches out of my arm, and they took me right back to the same hospital that I had just come from. That was the reality of using drugs for me. I couldn't stop. And I didn't stop. And I remember my father coming to New Jersey, and I had this bandage on my arm, and I remember the look on his face and not being able to explain to him why I hated myself so much that I wanted to destroy myself, that I wanted to take my own life, that I was so empty and so alone and so afraid that I couldn't explain to anybody why I was doing the things to myself that I was doing. And I never want to forget how that feels. Process of events, a lot of insanity and a lot more pain. I ended up in another hospital, and I ended up going to Crownsville. And some way, somehow, I had the desire not to go back to where I'd come from. And when I came into the fellowship, you know, I started coming back around the rooms, and I hadn't used with any of these people, and these people didn't know me. And they opened their arms to me. And they told me that that if I wanted to stop using, that I could. And guys like Randy and Kevin and Steve, and, you know, they love me, man, absolutely. Without reservation. And I'm responsible to love other people like that. I stayed clean for 11 and a half months. I stayed abstinent from drugs. And I was miserable. God, I was miserable. Because I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't going to meetings on a regular basis. I wasn't involved in a fellowship. I wasn't working any kind of steps. I was just white-knuckling it, toughing it out. Just, oh, God. And I was living with this woman from New Jersey that I had met when I was using. And I came home from work one day, and I flipped over the kitchen table. I took a glass, and I slammed it up against the wall, and it broke. And her daughter, about, I guess she was about 2 and a half, 3 years old, started screaming and crying, and I picked her up off her feet by her throat. And at that instant, I knew that drugs were no longer my problem. I knew that this was not just about not using. Because once I cleaned up on the outside, I had to start cleaning up on the inside. And I knew that if I didn't do something to change, that I was going to get high. And she left me. And I have a son that's almost 8 years old with her now that lives in Florida. And it's sad. And it's painful. And I feel guilty. And I feel ashamed. And I've had to do a lot of writing and a lot of work to make some kind of peace with that. I got a sponsor, and lo and behold, he said, work the steps. Used to be, work the steps or die, motherfucker. But now, that's right. That's right. But now I think they say more, work the steps and live. Work the steps and find freedom. Work the steps and find love and happiness. And I need both of those messages, you know? And so when I started working a step, the first time that I came to the first step, all it needed to mean to me was that I could not control the use of drugs. That's all it meant, and that's all it needed to mean. And the first time that I came to the second step, all it meant was that if I went to these Narcotics Anonymous meetings, that I had a chance to stay clean, and that's all it needed to mean. I didn't know anything about the disease of addiction and spiritual principles and higher power, and I didn't know. I didn't want to know. I just wanted to stop using. But then, when I really started working a step, what I found was, as it said, that we admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, and our lives would become unmanageable. And what it forced me to do was it forced me to take the focus off the things outside of myself, because I wanted to say drugs and people, places and things, and I wanted to look at all these things outside myself, but that's not what the first step was asking me to look at. The first step was asking me to surrender, to get honest, and surrender and accept the fact that there's a monster inside of me that wants to take my life, that I got cancer on my soul, and it wants to kill me. It wants to keep me from living, and it is more powerful than I am. And left to my own devices, it will kill me. If it isolates me, I'm dead. And it took a long time for me to come to understand that recovery, that abstinence and recovery are not equivalent, and that abstinence is the foundation on which my recovery is built. And when I come to understand that self-centered fear is the nature of the beast for this addict, I started to learn what recovery was. And the reason that I think that's so imperative is because it doesn't matter how long I've been clean or how many times I've worked the steps, I'm still an addict. I still have the disease of addiction, and it still wants my life, and it still wants to keep me from living. So because I get 10 years or 15 years or 50 years clean, it doesn't matter. I'm still capable of going back to using drugs if I'm not recovering from the disease of addiction. And what I found is that if I'm recovering from the disease of addiction, staying clean takes care of itself. My favorite line in the basic text is that we have never seen an addict relapse who lives in Narcotics Anonymous program. Never. It promises me. It promises me freedom from active addiction if I do what I'm supposed to do. The second step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That's where I found hope. The first God that I came to understand, and the first unconditional love that I got, was in the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, and it was in the people's hearts that are in these rooms. Because God to me is not that thing in the clouds that I jump pews to talk about. God to me is that thing that we all have inside of us that I need for you to share with me so that I can stay clean. And my God doesn't care whether I say fuck or not. My God doesn't care if I have $1 million or whether I got $10. My God cares about how I relate to reality, how I relate to other people, how I relate to myself. What I found that the second step was talking about was that through spiritual living, through practicing spiritual principles, that I could have a life, that I could learn to love myself. And to me, you hear people say, the second step says could. To me, that's not a question. To me, that's a statement that says it will. It possesses the ability to. It's not like, maybe my higher power will and maybe he won't. That's not what it's saying. It's saying that it possesses the power to free me from active addiction. And it's been a process of learning to trust in the spiritual principles. Addicts loving me unconditionally in spite of myself. And I'm not talking about when I first got clean. I'm talking about with lots of time. The third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I couldn't get with that. The word God made me sick to my stomach. It made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, and I was like, no. And what I did the first time that I worked the third step, what I did was is I made a decision to do what the recovering addicts and Narcotics Anonymous were doing. That's how I got around the word God. What I did was I made the choice and I made the commitment to do what people that were staying clean and changing were doing. That was the choice that I made. That was the decision that I made to go on and work the rest of the steps. And it's grown into a very personal relationship and a very personal commitment. And what the third step says to me now is that unconditional love is the absolute most important thing in my life. I have a job and I have kids and I have all these things, but the absolute most important thing in my life is my relationship with my higher power. Because everything is an extension of that. And if I don't choose and make the commitment and take the responsibility to do that, it'll make the decision for me. Fourth step, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. When I got here, I was a gunslinging, whore-chasing, dope-shooting, bad motherfucker. I wasn't afraid of shit. I'd go up on Barclay Street, 14th and U, and I didn't give a flat fuck about nothing. And it wasn't that I was that tough. I just didn't care. I was so full of hate. And after I wrote the fourth step, man, I was a sick, scared, lonely, suffering little kid. Whew. I was like, God. And what it did is it forced me to look at the reality of myself. It forced me to look at my whole life. I thought I was chasing something, but I was running from something, and that was myself. And I created this ego and this lie, and I created all this stuff in my mind because I couldn't deal with the reality of what I was. A thief and a liar and a whore and just a common, dirty, rotten, low-down, no-good, scumbag abscess on the face of this earth, man. Right? I hated myself. And I'm writing my fifth fourth step right now. And what I've been able to do is I've been able to learn that the fourth step isn't just about looking at all these miserable things that I've done. That the fourth step is about me evaluating my values. It's about me looking at my morals. It's about me looking at the way that I treat myself and the way that I don't or do value myself. And I share this reluctantly because it's misconstrued, but the first time that I wrote the fourth step, I didn't write all the things that I had done. I couldn't. I didn't trust anybody that much. I felt so ashamed and so unlovable and so unworthy and so undeserving. I swore that if I told somebody else some of the things that I had done, that they would laugh at me, that they would validate the piece of shit that I thought that I was. And I was scared. And what that did is it bought me some time. I don't suggest that to anybody, but it helped me. It allowed me to clean up enough of that dirt and enough of that self-destructiveness to get to the fourth step again. And the second time I wrote the fourth step, I put everything on there. I've compromised myself in more ways than I could care to tell you. I remember having sex with this woman that weighed about 350 pounds. Oh my God. Whew. That was rough, let me tell you. I'd have done anything for $50, man, I tell you. And it was funny, you know, and I wrote about it and it was funny, but let me tell you, I felt squashed. That's how I felt. I don't weigh 150 pounds soaking wet, so. But it made me feel ashamed, it made me feel dirty, and that's just like the funny stuff. You know, we all got that stealing from our families and all that stuff. The first line in the fifth step says that the fifth step is the key to freedom. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. That was the absolute hardest thing that I had done in recovery up to that point. was not easy for me. I'm not one of these people that says, oh, the fourth step was easy and I just shared and I had nothing, man. I was scared to death. And I came in there feeling vulnerable. I came in there feeling insecure. I came in there with my walls up and my ego out because I was afraid to let somebody else know how ugly and how dirty and how capable of self-destruction that I was. And fortunately, I had a sponsor that respected how sacred the fifth step is. And when I shared with him about having sex with things that aren't human, he might have been laughing inside, but he didn't laugh outside. When I shared with him about physically abusing people in my life because I wanted to take my misery out on them, he didn't get up and walk away. I told him one time, you know, I was watching my little brother, my father was in the Army and we were getting ready to go somewhere, and my brother was probably about 3 or 4 years old, and some guys came by to go cop some dope, and I left him sitting on a curb by himself so I could go get high. And he was crying his eyes out when my parents got there, and my father beat the living shit out of me, man. And you know something? I was glad he did. Because I felt so bad that I needed to get high, that I was willing to do that. You know, and I still feel pain about that. When I see my little brother, that's in my men's thing, and that's what I'm working on. Is, you know, and I had to own up to how many people I'd harmed and how much I'd harmed myself. And I think what the fifth step is about for me is about taking responsibility for my value system. It's about not blaming anybody else, and it's about not being the victim, and it's about me saying I am responsible for who I am. And I am responsible for the things that I have done, not the person that I had become. It says in the basic text that we're not responsible because of the disease of addiction, but what I mean is that I did those things and I have to learn to accept and forgive and let those things go for myself. And what the fifth step forces me to do is it forces me to own that pain. It forces me to own the fact that I am who I am. But what it also does is it provides me the solution. It allows me to look at the fact that I have unconditional love, that I have honesty, that I have willingness, that I care about people, that I'll do anything to change. Sixth step, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. First time I came to that, it was like, please help me. I'm begging you. You know, they were kicking my ass, man. And I was just pleading with God. And what I come to believe, what I understand about the sixth step for me, it's about acquiring an attitude. It's about me acquiring the desire not to be the same self-centered, miserable, hateful, taking, you know, person that I was. That I want to be freed from those defects. And I don't believe that defects and shortcomings are different things. A lot of people say that, but I don't believe that. And what I'm trying to do in the sixth step is I'm trying to get the attitude of practicing these principles above all my fears and above all my feelings and doing the right thing regardless of what other people think and what other people say. Because it's not about what other people say about me or how other people feel about me. It's about how I feel about myself. And that other people aren't responsible for my self-esteem and other people aren't responsible for the person that I am. And the sixth step tells me that I have to be willing to go through the changes and the pain and face the fears of letting down my walls and making myself vulnerable and telling people that I'm hurting, that I need help, and trying to keep my ass in front of my face. My first sponsor used to say that to me all the time. This is not about looking good and sounding good. It's about me saving my life. And the seventh step, you know, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. I don't, you know, people talk about, but people say that it's about not acting out, and I don't think that's what it's about for me. What I think the seventh step is about for me is about accepting the fact that I do not have the power to fix myself, that I need the love of a higher power, and that I need the love of people in my life, and that Humility to me isn't acting meek and humble and saying all the right stuff and crossing my legs and talking properly. Humility is learning to love myself for who I am. Humility is learning to be in my own skin and learn to be okay. Learning not to take other people's inventory. And what I found is that the more honest I am, the less dishonest I am. The more open-minded I am, the less judgmental I am. You know, and with the seven, because I'm not asking God to free me from jealousy so I don't act out and punch somebody in the mouth. That's not what I'm asking God to do. I'm asking God to free me from that sickness, that self-centeredness. I'm asking God to clean me up so that I can be alive and that I can participate in living. And that when other people say things about me and put me down and talk about me, that I can just accept those things, that I'm human and that I have defects and that it's okay. It's okay. God loves me anyway. And when I say God, I don't mean like this entity in the clouds. I mean spiritual living, spiritual principles, unconditional love. All those things are interchangeable to me. You know, I'm not caught up in that. Whatever God is to me and whatever God is to anybody else is okay. The eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. For me, it's about self-forgiveness. It's about learning to separate the person that I was from the person that I'm becoming. It's about taking a look at my relationships. It's about me saying that I've been self-centered and that every relationship I've been in my life is because I wanted something, because I was playing the angle, because I was trying to get something. And I didn't care about how the other person felt or how it affected the other person. I just wanted mine. And what the eighth step forces me to do is it forces me to take a look at my motives and my behavior and my actions, and it forces me to own the fact that I need to change the way that I relate. And I need to learn to let go of who I was and who I'm becoming, because self-forgiveness is what's enabled me to become willing. The more that I know that I need to forgive myself, the easier it is for me to forgive other people. The last charge that I copped was I hit this guy in the head with a hammer. And I was going to kill him. I swear to fucking God. And when I got to the 8-step list, I would not put his name on the list. I said I'll die shooting dope before I put this guy's name on the list. And push had come to shove, and I was either going to have to go back to getting high or put this guy's name on the list. And I put it on the list because I didn't want to use. And now he spends more time with my older son than I do. He lives in Florida, and he's more of a dad to my older son than I am. And it was hard. But the eighth step is between me and my higher power, and it's asking me, who do I want to be? How do I want to relate to people? Because recovery to me is about relationships. Recovery to me is about spiritual relationships. It's about a relationship with my higher power. It's about a relationship with myself, and it's about a relationship with other people. That's what recovery is about for me, trying to do the right thing, trying to feel good about myself. And the ninth step, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Man, I thought it was about apologizing like most people do. Yeah, I'm a scumbag and I stole all your money and, you know, I know all that, and go ahead and beat me up or whatever you want to do. But that wasn't, you know, what the ninth step is about for me. It's about changing. It's about doing it differently. It's about living differently. It's about cleaning up the way that I actually relate to people. The first time that I would to work the ninth step, it was Christmas Eve. I had a year and whatever, almost 2 years clean. And I remember going to my parents' house, and my parents wouldn't let me in at one time. And I remember going to their house, and it was Christmas Eve, and I had a couple presents, and we're standing in the kitchen. And I remember saying, there's something that I need to say. And my father got choked up. He said, no, it's okay. You don't need to say it. And my mother started crying, and she said, it's okay. And I said, no, I need to say it for myself. You know? And I told him that I loved him, and that the hurt that I caused him was a result of my own self-destructiveness, and that I was trying to be the best human being and the best son that I could be, and my father's crying and my mother's crying, and they give me a hug, and we're standing in the kitchen hugging, and I'm crying, and it's like, that's what Narcotics Anonymous promised me, that I could have a life, that I could amend those relationships. I used to date this girl. She lived with me. I wasn't dating. It was insanity. And she danced in this bar up in the city. You know what kind of bar I'm talking about. And I treated her very badly. I threw her out in the middle of the night in the snow. She banging on the door, crying, screaming, neighbors calling the police. I wouldn't